For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, good day. It's good to be with you. And I've looked forward to this time. I have great admiration for this church. And I know not all of you go to Xenos, but this conference and what this church stands for is really very exciting, and I'm glad to be a part of it. In the middle of the 20th century, Harvard sociologist Pitram Sorokin published a book called The Crisis of Our Age. And in that book, he analyzed different kinds of cultures, and he classified them into two fundamentally different kinds of cultures. He called them a sensate culture and an ideational culture. Now, a sensate culture, according to Sorokin, was a culture that only believes that the physical, sense-perceptible universe exists. So for a sensate culture, the only thing that is real is what you can see, touch, taste, smell, or hear around you. That is a sensate culture. A sensate culture, an example of a sensate culture would be Britain or Germany in the first half of the 20th century, for example. Now, an ideational culture, by contrast, is a culture that not only believes that there is a sense-perceptible world, but also that there is a huge realm of reality beyond the senses that is not physical, that's real. And the vast majority of the cultures in the history of the human race have been ideational. Now, Sorokin made the point that sensate cultures don't last very long because they don't have the intellectual resources to sustain human flourishing. That if you try to make sense out of a flourishing life, if you try to answer the big questions of life, like, is there a God? Is there life after death? What ought I do and what ought I not do? None of those questions in philosophy or theology or ethics or political theory or aesthetic theory, none of the questions that matter most to us can be answered by an appeal to sense experience. It follows, therefore, that if you are a part of a sensate culture, you will give up on the possibility of answering the big questions because they can't be resolved by science or by the five senses. And then it will follow that in a sensate culture, the satisfaction of desire will trump the search for truth. Because you can't find truth that matters with your five senses. So if you live in a culture that has given up on the possibility of there being truth that you can't prove with your senses, people will no longer guide their lives by truth. Something else will then come to take the place of truth as the guiding principle of life, and typically what will come to take the place of truth will be living for the satisfaction of my desires. Now, America is becoming increasingly sensate as a culture. This became evident a few years ago in Time magazine, where the cover story on Time magazine was the question, how will the universe end? You open the article, and the article says that human beings for millennia have wanted to know how all this was going to end. Unfortunately, the article said, the only way that humans could try to answer their questions were through the methods of philosophy and religion, which amount to nothing but idle speculation. Now, the article went on to say, for the very first time in the history of the human race, science has moved in to this area of inquiry, and as a result, for the first time in human history, we now actually know answers to our questions. Now, what is being communicated in the Time magazine article is that science and science alone can give us knowledge of reality. And anything outside of science, all of the humanities, from ethics to literature, to philosophy, to theological studies, to art, cannot give us factual knowledge about the real world. It follows then that in our educational institutions, we are increasingly becoming sensate. I was talking to one of you yesterday who is involved at Ohio State in the political science department. And the person was telling me that the political science department here at Ohio State is increasingly trying to become empirical in its teaching and its methodology. To me, that's a mistake, because that is going to be the reduction of political theory to empirical tests. By contrast, I just had a former student complete a PhD in political science at Claremont Graduate School in Southern California, and that program emphasizes the philosophy and the history of political theory, and it doesn't place a great deal of emphasis on empirical methods. Now, it can be a both and, but the difference is that the Claremont School of political theory is ideational, and Ohio State is becoming sensate. The more sensate our universities and our culture become, the more people will give up on the quest for truth, and religion will be privatized, and it will be reduced to a matter of personal feeling and blind faith, and people will ultimately not be governed by the lordship of Jesus. Instead, they will be governed by what satisfies their immediate desires. Now, as a result of that, it is important for us Christians to understand this contemporary incarnation of a sensate culture and how to respond to it. And the contemporary incarnation of a sensate culture is a part of a worldview struggle that's going on today in America. Currently, there are three worldviews that are vying for the allegiance of the hearts and minds of the American people. One of them is Christianity, I'm happy to say. Christianity, in my opinion, is a growingly robust, vibrant worldview and approach to life. And I believe we have very good years ahead of us. I'm excited about what I'm seeing happen. So I'm encouraged in that regard. We have a lot of work to do, but there are good things happening. And if you'd like, after we have some time together, I'm going to try to leave the last 10 or 15 minutes for a Q&A time where you can go to a microphone. And if you want to ask me about that, that'd be fine. The second worldview is postmodern relativism. I recognize that there are many versions of postmodernism. I don't think every version is relativistic, but the vast majority of clear-thinking postmodernists tend to claim that all reality and truth is relative to your culture or your community, so that what's real for one culture and community is not necessarily real for another culture and another community. Postmodern relativism tends to dominate the arts and the entertainment industry, and is constantly communicated through movies and TV shows and in music. By far the most dominant worldview today is philosophical naturalism. And it is the worldview that dominates the money centers of the university, and it wears the trousers in American culture. The media regularly consult scientific naturalists to speak authoritatively about issues in our culture. This became very clear to me years ago in the Columbine tragedy, where we as a nation for about 2 weeks were trying to find out an answer to a question. And the question was, what is happening in youth culture? And in those days, Tom Brokaw and Peter Jennings was still on the air, and Dan Rather. And you had CBS, ABC, NBC, CNN, and Time and Newsweek and so on. For a week to two, trying to answer the question, what's happening to youth culture? Now, here's what's interesting. To whom did we turn to answer our question? And the answer was not youth ministers. which would have been one of the first places I would have gone. I would have asked youth pastors. We turn to S-C-I-E-N-T-I-S-T-S, scientists. So on the front of Newsweek magazine, there was a picture of the human brain about 4 or 5 days after Columbine with the title, "Does a Defect in Brain Chemistry Cause Events Like Columbine?" And so it was neuroscientists, social scientists, and psychologists that were given the right to speak with authority by the American people if what we were after was knowledge of reality. Now, we're after comfort. The ministers were allowed to come and sing the national anthem and before the game began and comfort the families. But when it came to actually giving knowledge of the situation, given that we live in a more and more naturalistic culture, the scientists were given the authority to speak when it came to knowledge. Now, folks, this is a bad situation because what's happened in the Christian community is that we have ceded knowledge to science and we have accepted faith. And our religion is now supposed to be about faith. And as I'm going to talk about in the next hour, Christianity is not fundamentally a religion of faith. It is fundamentally a religion of knowledge. Christianity gives us knowledge of reality, not faith about reality. The Bible never where says that you have to simply believe in God. In Hebrews, it says that believing in God is a necessary condition for coming to Him, but it doesn't say it's sufficient. To come to God, you have to know there's a God, and it's possible to actually know that He's there. So now this raises the question for us, what is naturalism? And what I'd like to do is to spend a little bit of time unpacking naturalism, and then I'd like to give just a little bit of a critique of it, perhaps as we go along. There are three aspects to a naturalistic worldview. If you want to understand how a naturalist sees the world, there are three different things you have to understand, and if you get clear on those, you've got it. And the first component of a naturalistic worldview is the naturalist epistemology, or that's a $1.98 word, for the naturalist theory of knowledge. The naturalist theory of knowledge. By the way, are we feeling any love yet? Have we started bonding? Is that going on? Just want to sense a little love. Okay, good. Thank you. All right. Now, I just want to loosen us up a little bit. This is a heavy subject, but I want us to just be relaxed and loose. So let's just feel the love, ladies and gentlemen. All right. Thank you. That's great. Now, don't go overboard with it, but okay. There are two aspects of the naturalist epistemology or theory of knowledge. The first is a commitment to scientism. Scientism is basically the idea that science and science alone can give us knowledge of reality. Science and science alone can give us knowledge of reality. I was invited to a dinner party years ago in Baltimore, where I was going to be sharing the gospel with people who were inviting their friends. And one young man told me that he was going to bring his boss, who had a PhD in physics from Johns Hopkins, who'd been an engineer for 30-some years, who hated Christians and went out of his way to go after them if he found out they were believers. And so I said, well, it'll be interesting. And so this gentleman, I'm at the hors d'oeuvre table, and this gentleman, I can see my friend and a stranger come in. It's obvious this man. And they come over to the hors d'oeuvre table. Well, we introduce ourselves to each other, and no sooner do we shake hands. And this gentleman begins to launch into me and said, well, I understand you're a philosopher and a theologian. And I said, well, I give it my best shot. And he said, well, yeah, I used to be interested in philosophy and that kind of stuff when I was a teenager. But he said, I outgrew it when I became a mature adult. Now, I'm not kidding. He said, because now I realize that if you can't prove it and test it empirically in the laboratory and verify it in the lab, it's nothing but a bunch of hot air. You got to be able to measure your data and test it scientifically, then you can know it. If you can't, it's just a bunch of idle opinion. That is scientism. It's the attitude that science and science alone is a safe guide to reality. That's the naturalist epistemology. Now, just very briefly, by way of critique here, there are two things I would say against scientism. And the first one is that it is self-refuting. A claim is self-refuting if it makes itself false. So the sentence, there's no sentence longer than three words, is self-refuting. That sentence is itself longer than three words, and it makes itself false. If someone claims to know that you can't know anything outside the hard sciences, that claim cannot itself be tested by any of the hard sciences. There is no experiment in physics or chemistry or biology or geology that will tell you whether or not that claim is true. As a matter of fact, the assertion, you can only know what science can prove, or you can only know what you can see, touch, taste, smell, or hear, which are both self-refuting claims, they are not claims of science, they're claims of philosophy about science. And they're actually claims in the field of epistemology. They're not biological assertions. You won't learn anything about that claim in physical chemistry classes or in studying magnetism. They are not scientific assertions. They're philosophical assertions to the effect that we can't know any philosophical assertions. And it's self-refuting. And so I let this gentleman go on for a couple of minutes, and I finally said, look, I said, I've got a real problem here, and I don't know what to do with it. I said, you claim that science is, that if you can't prove and test something scientifically, it's hot air and idle opinion. And I said, you've made 30 or 40 assertions for the last 2 minutes, and I can't think of a single thing that's come out of your mouth that I could test scientifically. I don't know what to do, because that means that by your own standards, your own assertions have been nothing but hot air and idle opinion, and that's just kind of a tough situation. So it was a shocking thing to him. He'd never had anybody ever point that out to him. And he immediately changed the subject and went off on something else. It was kind of interesting. But the point is that scientism is self-refuting. The second problem with scientism is that it does not allow for the assumptions of science to be known. It doesn't allow for the assumptions of science to be known. Science is based upon a number of assumptions. And those assumptions cannot be known by science. They're assumed by science. If science is the only way we have of knowing reality, then we can't know the assumptions of science. And if we can't know the assumptions of science, it follows that whatever is based upon those assumptions, namely science, cannot itself be known. Now let me run that by you one more time. So stay with me on it. The assumptions of science are essential for science to be a subject of knowledge. If the assumptions of science are bogus or confused, then science is going to be confused. The problem is that you can't know the assumptions of science by the methods of science. For example, next hour I'm going to define truth and knowledge for you. Science assumes a picture of truth, and it assumes a view of what knowledge looks like, and neither one of those subjects are things that can be discovered in science. Science has to assume a picture of truth, and it has to assume a definition of knowledge before it can even claim to offer us true knowledge of reality. But the nature of truth and the nature of knowledge are not themselves topics that science can discuss. Here's another example, logic and mathematics. Logic and mathematics are called a priori disciplines, A-P-R-I-O-R-I. That means that they are fields that do not appeal to sense experience to make their claims. If you're going to do a proof in logic or math, you don't appeal to something that you can see, touch, taste, smell, or hear in order to make your proof. Proofs in logic and math are known as a priori disciplines. They are not known on the basis of experimentation and sense experience. Science is a posteriori. A posteriori means that science bases its claims on sense experience. The claims of chemistry and physics are known on the basis of experimentation and things of that sort. Logic and math aren't known by experimentation and empirical testing. They're known in a different way. And as a matter of fact, logic and mathematics are presuppositions of science. Science has to assume things in logic and math before it can do its work. But science itself cannot make any proofs in logic and math, because the methods of science are a posteriori, relying upon the senses. They're not a priori, making arguments independent of the senses. And so, what's the point I'm making? I'm not sure. I'm lost in the middle of my lecture. But I'm in Xenos. That's right. Okay. Thank you, ma'am. the point I'm making is that scientism is a bogus epistemology because it's self-refuting and because it rests upon assumptions that are not themselves scientific. What assumptions? I could list a bunch of them, but a couple of them are that what knowledge and truth are, and the truths of logic and mathematics, which are not themselves things that can be proven scientifically. Now, I think at this point I'm going to just leave that alone and say that that's fundamentally the epistemology of naturalism. There's more that one could say, but let's just leave it at that. The fundamental epistemology is that science is our ideal and only real guide to truth and reality. The second aspect of the naturalist worldview is their creation story. A naturalist owes us an account of how everything that exists came into being. They don't get off the hook on this. They have to tell us a story about how everything that exists came into being. And their story is characterized by two fundamental principles. The first part of the story is characterized by what philosophers call combinatorial processes. What that means, that's a $1.98 way of saying that the story involves little tiny things that combine to form larger things, and the processes then take them to combine to form larger things, and the whole history of the universe is the history of subatomic particles combining to form not electrons, but protons and neutrons, then protons and neutrons combining to form atoms, atoms combining to form molecules, molecules combining to form living organisms, and to form everything from planets and galaxies to Homo sapiens and lizards and frogs and lions and tigers and bears. Thank you. So that is basically the story. Everything that exists in reality is ultimately a structure of subatomic particles. You are a collection of atoms and molecules in a certain physical arrangement. What makes you different from a dog, let's say, is the particles you're made up of and the structural arrangement of the particles. Okay? So the history of the universe is a history of, since the Big Bang, it's a history of the unfolding and the combination of particles, subatomic particles, to form everything that has come to be. The story is, at its core, combinatorial. Now, I won't have time to develop this thought, but it will follow that the atheist will not be able to explain things that aren't combinations. An example of things that aren't combinations would be consciousness and colors and sounds and tastes. An atheist cannot explain where the color red or yellow came from. He can't explain where a feeling of pain or a thought that lunch was good came from. Because consciousness is simple, it's not structural, and the color red is not a wavelength of light. It is a simple qualitative thing that may be caused by a wavelength of light or correlated it. Wavelengths are combinations, but colors aren't. So the point is that one of the first weaknesses of the creation story for the naturalist is they cannot explain what are called emergent properties. They cannot explain the origin of properties that aren't structural combinations of subatomic stuff. Think of it like this. Atoms and molecules are colorless, tasteless, odorless particles. You with me? How in the world can you take colorless, odorless, tasteless particles, put them in a different geometrical arrangement, and presto, get color popping into existence? It's absolute magic without a magician. And there's no explanation for it whatsoever. Same with consciousness. How can you take particles and put them in the form of neurons C-fibers and things like that to form the brain, and all of a sudden get thoughts and feelings and beliefs and ideas popping into existence? There is no account for the origin of mind or colors and tastes on the basis of this principle. So the first part of the story is these combinatorial processes, and the second part of the story about the creation story about how everything came about is deterministic at its core. The world is a deterministic world at its very core. I had a debate with the head of the California Humanist Society. He's an ACLU lawyer, and we did a debate, and he basically said that according to an atheistic naturalist view of the world, the universe is a deterministic closed system of cause and effect without any intervention from the outside. What he didn't realize is that eliminated free will as well. It didn't just eliminate God intervening. It keeps me from being able to raise my own stinking arm. Because when I raise my arm, I have to exercise freedom into the system. And so his view was deterministic. Not only did it rule God out, it ruled out human actions. But more about that in just a minute. So the story is deterministic in two senses. First, through time. It is deterministic through time. That means that the universe unfolds over time according to the laws of chemistry and physics. And the universe at any particular time, plus the laws of chemistry and physics, either determine or fix the probabilities for the next state of the universe. So you get what is called diachronic or through time determinism. The second kind of determinism that's at the core of this story is called synchronic or at a time determinism. And that's the determinism of a whole by its physical parts. The behavior of whole objects is completely determined by the properties and the behaviors of its microphysical particles. Think about the mass of an object, for example, of a rock. The mass of a rock is completely determined by the sum total of the mass of its particles that make it up. Does that make sense to you? Now, it's gonna follow from this, for example, that there will be no free will. And this has affected the judicial system. Because liberal secular judges who buy into this deterministic picture find it difficult to blame or to have praise and blame and genuine responsibility on the part of criminals. And so you get what is called therapeutic justice. And therapeutic justice takes the criminal into account and says what we need to do is not to hold him accountable, but rehabilitate him or her, because that person is every bit as much a victim of his genetics and his environment as the victim is, because nobody has the free choice to engage in responsibility. Do you see then, in a naturalist view of the world, it will become increasingly difficult to have what's called robust or libertarian freedom, a real robust sense of the ability to choose freely without my actions being controlled by things outside my control. In a naturalistic worldview, our behaviors are all determined by the laws of chemistry and physics and by our environmental inputs. So this is basically The second feature of the grand story, let me give you a third one that's going to be very relevant to a text I'm going to look at tonight. But this, the first feature, remember, this creation story is that it tells a story of how things particles combine to form everything. The second feature of the story is that it's deterministic in two senses. It's deterministic through time. The laws of physics and the state of the universe fix the next state of the universe, and it's deterministic from parts to whole. So it's deterministic at a point in time. The third part of the story is that it eschews or sets aside or rejects teleology and purposes. Teleology and purposes. Now, teleology it was something Aristotle called a final cause. A final cause. And let's just think about this for a minute. If the water's boiling, I can ask the question, why is the water boiling? And I can answer that by appealing to what is called an efficient cause. An efficient cause is what produces the boiling. So if you were to say to me, why is the water boiling? I might say it's because the gases in the stove are combusting, and that's releasing energy. That energy is being absorbed by the water on the stove. That is causing the molecules to get agitated, and that they reach a certain agitation level and they're able to escape from the liquid phase into the gas phase. That's why the water is boiling. Look what I've done. I've told you a story of a series of efficient causes where one cause produces an effect that tends to produce another effect, and that eventually produces the effect of the water being released into the atmosphere. And that's a deterministic story, told in terms of efficient causes. Now, I can also say the water's boiling so we can have tea. And that would be to explain why the water's boiling in terms of a purpose. Are you with me? And that is a future or a final cause. The water is boiling for the sake of, in order to have tea. Now, the naturalist says that there are no final causes. This was a big part of the Darwinian Revolution, that there is nothing that happens for the sake of a purpose, including human action. Human action does not, you are not here today because you came here for a purpose. You may think that you're here because you came here to learn something or to grow or whatever it might be. You might think you had a telos, an end, a goal. And you came here, listen to my language, in order to attain that goal, for the sake of achieving that goal. You may think that, but that's not true. You were caused to come here by subconscious drives and motives that are sometimes outside of conscious awareness. Nothing, including human action, happens for a purpose. And as we're going to see this evening in the plenary session, the fact that this idea that nothing happens for a purpose is now widely accepted in the American culture has led to a 10 to 12-fold increase in depression. And these are the worldview roots of depression. Okay? And where does this come from? It comes from accepting a naturalist view of the world that only accepts efficient causes and sets aside final causes or teleology or purposeful explanations. The third component of the naturalist worldview is the ontology or its view of what's real. It's the view of what's real. And basically, the ontology of the naturalist is physicalism. Only the physical world exists, and everything that exists is physical or in some way depends on the physical. So that the physical world is all there is. By the way, this is one of the problems with consciousness. It's been so interesting to me because this is my specialization in philosophy, philosophy of mind. And it's been interesting that since the 1930s, up until, it's still happening, but up until maybe 10 years ago, the entire Western world philosophy departments were trying to get rid of consciousness and trying to say that consciousness really isn't real. It's just nothing but brain processes. And the reason for that is that a naturalist cannot explain where consciousness comes from. Because if you start with unconscious brute particles and deterministically rearrange them according to the laws of chemistry and physics into a new structure, you know what you're going to have? A new structure of mindless particles. You're not going to get mind coming into existence. If you're interested in this argument, I wrote a book on it called The Recalcitrant Imago Dei. It's something that you might want to read before you go to bed. It'll put you to sleep, I guarantee it. Okay, so now let's just step back. What does a naturalist believe about the world? The naturalist says, my epistemology is that the sciences, the hard sciences, are our only or major source of knowledge of reality. I claim that was problematic because A, it was self-refuting, and B, it does not allow for us to know the presuppositions of science, like what is truth, what is knowledge, and the propositions of logic and mathematics. The second thing is this story, this creation story. The first characteristic of the creation story is that the whole world is told in terms of a new combination of things that already existed from the Big Bang to the present, so it's a combinatorial story. The second part of the story is that it's deterministic. It's deterministic through time, from one moment to the next, and it's deterministic at any time from parts to whole. A problem is that there's not going to be a room on this story I told you for consciousness, for the existence of things like colors and sounds, and it's not going to have any room for free will. And then the third part of the story is that you can only allow for efficient causes. You can't allow for purposes or final causes. Daniel Dennett, bless his heart, wrote a book a few years ago called Darwin's Dangerous Idea. And it was that given God doesn't exist and Darwinism is true, nothing happens for a purpose, including my writing this book. He literally said that. I'm not writing this book for any particular purpose. Which strikes one as highly insincere. It's pretty obvious that he had a whole bunch of purposes for writing the book. So one difficulty with all this is that there's not going to be teleology or purpose in the world. And then the final aspect of this worldview is a materialist or physicalist view of the world, according to which only the physical world exists. And nothing that isn't ultimately reducible or dependent on the physical can be said to be real. And a problem with that is going to be to explain the consciousness, because consciousness cannot be reduced to the brain. Consciousness is disgustingly invisible. You can see, touch, taste, smell, and hear the brain, but you can't see, touch, taste, smell, or hear your own thoughts or beliefs or your conscious life. And so this raises the problem of where can you get consciousness. Now, I've already started critiquing this worldview. So in my exposition of naturalism, I've already given you some reasons why I'm not a naturalist. The epistemology is self-refuting, can't make sense out of the assumptions of science. It can't explain the origin of consciousness or free will or purpose, why we act for purposes. So these are all problems with the worldview. Let me give you one other problem with it, and then I'll turn to a couple of major ones, and then we'll have Q&A. Remember me telling you that on this view, ordinary-sized objects are just collections of atoms and molecules held together by bonding relations in a certain structure, held together by the chemistry and the physics. You understand that? So take this podium. This podium is ultimately nothing but atoms and molecules held together in a certain structure. Now, that's probably true for the podium. The problem with that view is that if that's true, this podium can't literally be the same podium from one moment to the next if it loses parts and gains new parts. Because if I take a part of this off and replace it with a new part, it's not literally the same podium anymore. Why? Because the podium is nothing but a collection of parts. And if I change its parts, I've changed the object. I mean, think if you will, if I broke this down part by part, and every time I took a part of the podium off, and I assume this is, I don't know what this is made out of, some kind of metal, I broke it down and put it on the floor and replaced it with frozen green Jell-O. After a while, bless your heart. These people have not greeted me since I came in, but you have watched me. You've laughed at all my stupid comments. Okay, all right. So this object can't be the same if it changes its parts. But now we've got a problem. If all I am is a collection of atoms and molecules, I'm not the same person from one moment to the next, because I'm constantly gaining parts and losing parts, gaining more than I'm losing, unfortunately. But that, you know how that goes. But because I'm undergoing part replacement every day. If that's true, it follows that I'm not literally the same person that had breakfast back at the hotel this morning. Literally. There is no enduring self that can be remain the same through part replacement on this view. Well, if I'm not literally the same person from one moment to the next, then number one, I should never be punished for anything I did in the past because I didn't do it. Seriously, I'm not kidding. Secondly, I shouldn't fear going to the dentist because it won't be I that will go to the dentist. It will be someone with my memories that will look a lot like me but won't literally be I. It follows that I can't literally be the same person from one moment to the next, but I submit to you that we all know that we're the same person from one moment to the next by just being aware of ourselves. I know, without any doubt, that I am the same person right now that began this lecture, you know, 40 minutes ago. Now, if I'm the same person as I was an hour ago, then I can't be my body. Because my body is constantly gaining and losing parts. The only way that I could be the same person from one moment to the next is if I am a soul in addition to my body. And the reason I'm the same person from one moment to the next is because I'm the same soul that I was 45 minutes ago. But my body is constantly in flux and changing because it's undergoing part replacement. So another reason that I don't believe the naturalist account of the world is because it can't explain how I can be literally the same person from one moment to the next if I'm constantly gaining new parts and losing old parts. And I submit to you that we actually know that we're the same person from one moment to the next. And the best explanation of that fact, I contend, is that there is more to me than my body. Specifically, I have an I, or a soul, or a self, or an ego, call it what you want, that is not physical. And it is because I am the same ego through time that I'm able to retain my identity through part replacement and be the same. All right, those are some things that I would say initially against the naturalist worldview. Another objection I would raise against it is that the naturalist cannot explain the origin of the universe. The naturalist cannot explain the origin of the universe. And we now know, I think beyond reasonable doubt, that the universe began to exist. There are a lot of ways that we know that. Did I say something funny? No, because my friend didn't laugh. Somebody else laughed. All right. It's okay. So We now know, beyond reasonable doubt, that the universe began to exist. Let me give you a couple of ways we know this. Some of you, this may be old hat to you. Others, it may be new. So I don't know where you fall in that continuum, but let me just try a couple of points. Years ago, Aristotle discovered an argument that implies that the universe began to exist, that it hasn't been here forever. And the argument involves the impossibility of crossing infinity. It's impossible for anything to cross infinity. Even God can't cross infinity. It's impossible for God or for anything to cross infinity. And that's because infinity is infinitely larger than any finite number. Take any finite number. Infinity is infinitely larger than that. You with me? Suppose that infinity were not infinitely larger than any finite number. Then it would follow that infinity was finitely larger than a finite number. And we could add the two finite numbers and we'd get infinity, but it would be finite, and that's not infinity. So that's a proof that infinity is infinitely larger than any finite number. If you don't need the proof, then just accept it. Okay. Infinity is infinitely larger than any finite number. Now, if I go to heaven and God says, okay, Moreland, you love my son Jesus, but that Xenos lecture was off the charts bad. And so I got good and bad news. The good news is you get in. The bad news is I want you to count the natural numbers forever. So I start counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and I get up to 50 quadrillion zillion. Is there a medic? That one didn't sound so good. That sounded like you were losing something over there, ma'am. Okay, so I get up to 50 quadrillion zillion, and do you feel like a nose? I'm always picking on you. Okay, so, all right, fair enough. All right. Harvey, save me here, man. It's a bad crowd, I'm telling you. And so here's another guy that dies, and he's just started. He got the same assignment, and he's up to the number 75. And I'm a 50 quadrillion zillion. I look over at this guy and I think, that poor sucker, I'm way ahead of him. Until it dawns on me, we both have the same number of numbers left to count. I've made absolutely no progress whatsoever. Trying to go from zero to infinity is like trying to jump out of a pit with walls that go forever without edges on them. You're not going to ever get out. Now, if the universe never had a beginning, and we label the present moment at zero, and a year ago at minus one, and this is minus 50 billion years ago, and this is minus 50 quadrillion years ago. If the universe never had a beginning, then there's no edge back here, because if there were an edge, that would be the beginning. What this goes to is to minus infinity. If the universe never had a beginning, that means in order for the universe to reach zero, the present moment, it would have to cross through an infinite number of earlier moments to get here right now, which is impossible. So if the universe didn't have a beginning, the present moment could have never showed up. The only way the present moment could show up is if it was only preceded by a finite number of earlier moments, which means there had to be a start to all this. Now, the reason God can't cross infinity is because infinity can't be crossed, but he doesn't have to because without the created world, he was outside of time. He wasn't earlier than the creation because there wasn't any earlier. You with me? This is the beginning of time. He was outside time whatsoever. So we learn from this argument that the universe has only been here for a finite duration, and there was a beginning. We also know that there was a beginning to the universe because of the second law of thermodynamics, which basically says that the universe is running out of useful energy. The universe is using up its useful energy, or it's becoming more and more disordered. It's very interesting that Lord Kelvin, who was one of the people that discovered the second law and did some of the initial work on what's called entropy, drew the conclusion that there had to be a God. Because he said that if the universe is running out of energy, its useful energy, It couldn't have been doing that forever. Because if the universe had been using up its useful energy forever, it would have already run out of gas. Since it hasn't used up that useful energy yet, it could only have been using it up for a finite period of time, and it had to be wound up at some point in the past, and from that point on, it's been running out of gas. So if you apply the second law to the beginning of the universe, you get the idea that the universe has to have had a beginning, and we have then empirical confirmation of what we already have reason for philosophically, that the universe had a beginning. Now, here's the problem. Science will never explain the origin of the universe. Never. It never will. And this is not, my claim is not based upon the current status of our scientific knowledge. That would be a risky claim, because somebody could always say, well, give us another 50 to 100 years and we'll solve this problem. That's exactly what Richard Dawkins said to Bill O'Reilly on The Factor. When O'Reilly said to Dawkins, where did this come from? And Dawkins said, we're working on it. Well, we, you know, give us more time and we'll figure it out. What Dawkins didn't get, because he's just a scientist, he's not a philosopher, is that the problem with science's inability to explain the origin of the universe has nothing to do with the current limitations of scientific knowledge. It has everything to do with how science explains things. You see, science can't explain something until you've already got a universe. Science explains one thing in the universe by appealing to another thing in the universe and a law of nature that connects them. So we explain why the gas is at a certain temperature by appealing to a change in the pressure and volume of the gas, for example. Or we explain why Jupiter is at this particular point right now, because, 100 years ago it was at this point, or 5 days ago, and it moves at a certain velocity. You with me on that at this point? All scientific explanations presuppose that there is already a universe before they can start explaining. Therefore, science can't explain in principle the origin of the universe, because science can't start doing its explanatory work until you've already got a universe there to begin with. The most reasonable explanation for the origin of the universe is a personal creator, that it came from a personal God who spoke it into existence. And I don't have time to go into great detail on that, but that is a plausible thing to argue. Now, so what I would do for the naturalist, and I've just got a little bit of time left here, is I would fuss at the epistemology, like I've told you. I would fuss at the problem of consciousness, the problem of free will, the problem of acting for purposes, and the problem of how I can be the same through, even though I gain parts and lose parts, how could I still be the same self? I would fuss at all that, and then I would raise the problem of the origin of the universe. Where did this come from? And I found this to be very effective. And if you have an atheist friend who says, I don't believe in God, it's always a polite thing to ask, okay, where do you think all this came from? Where did the universe come from? Now, an atheist may say, well, where did God come from? And the problem with that question is, it's called in philosophy a category fallacy. A category fallacy is like, how many inches long is the smell of a rose? Or how many pounds does the color red weigh? A category fallacy is applying the wrong category to the wrong thing. I'm trying to make these points without being funny, for obvious reasons. Okay, so, and I'm obviously succeeding at it, ladies and gentlemen. So a category fallacy is the problem of applying the wrong category to the wrong thing. You can't apply the category of weight to notes, or width to tastes, for example. So the question, what made X? What made the planet Earth, or what made that building, or what made the solar system? The question, what made X, can only be asked of X's that are by definition makeable. You can only ask what made X of something which by definition is a makeable thing. God, by definition, is the unmakeable creator of everything. Given that that's the definition of God that I'm interested in, and by the way, atheists will grant that definition. They just don't think there is a God, but they'll agree on what we mean that we're debating. After all, when atheists and believers debate, they have to have some idea of what they're debating. And so they agree on what God would be if there were a God. The atheist just says there isn't one, and the believer says there is. But they agree on the definition. Now, the definition is that by God, I mean the uncreatable creator of everything else. You with me? Now, given that's what I mean by God, you can't ask what made God, because that becomes this question. What is it that made something that by definition can't be made? And that shows that the question is a category, it's a misguided question. Now, is this definition of God arbitrary? Is this definition of God arbitrary? No, and here's why. Here's why this definition of God as the uncreatable creator of everything is not an arbitrary definition. Suppose that we have a person here. Can you see me back here? We have a person A that wants to borrow an iPod. And he goes to B and says, "May I borrow an iPod from you? And B says, "You bet. I don't have an iPod, but I've got a friend C who's got one. I'll go to him and get it, and I'll loan it to you." So B goes to C and says, "I got a friend A. I want to give him an iPod. Can I borrow yours?" And C says, "Yeah, no problem. I don't have an iPod, but I've got a friend D that's got one, and then I'll loan it to you." So he goes to D and says, "I've got a friend B over here who wants to loan an iPod to his buddy A. Can you give me an iPod?" And D says, "You bet. I don't have one. I've got to go to E." Now, if this series keeps on going, I want you to notice what each member of the series is. Each member of the series is a borrowing lender. That means that each member can only lend if they first borrow, because they don't own it. You with me? So each member becomes a new borrowing member and a new borrowing member and a new borrowing member, where each member of the series can only lend if it first borrows. Now, if we keep adding borrowing lenders, and we even do that forever, is A down here ever going to get an iPod? He's never going to get an iPod if we keep adding even an infinite series of borrowing lenders, unless we stop with a member of the series that is totally different than all the rest of them. And this member has got to be an owning lender. This has got to be someone who had an iPod without having to borrow it first. He just has one somehow. Now, if he owns it, then he can loan it down the chain and A will get one, right? Does that make sense? Now, instead of iPods, let's talk about existence. A wants existence, but it says to B, "I need to borrow existence from you." Maybe B or its parents, I don't know. Let's not worry about that for right now. If it were rocks, it would be something else, a volcanic eruption or something. But let's just say A wants to get existence, and it goes to B and says, "Will you give me existence?" And B says, "Yeah, but I have to exist before I can give you existence, so I got to get existence from C." And so we keep this thing going, and every member of the chain is a borrowing lender of existence. It can only give existence to the next thing unless it first gets it. Does that make sense to you? Now, if you don't stop this with a first member that is an owning lender of existence, nothing would exist. And that owning lender of existence is something that just exists without getting it from something else. It exists in and of itself. Now, you can't ask of that first member what caused it, or else it wouldn't be first. So given that God is the first cause, you can't say what caused God, or else you're treating God as a second or third or fourth cause and not a first cause. So we can ask what caused the universe, because we all know it came into existence. But we can't ask what caused God, because by definition, he's the first cause, and that's not an arbitrary definition. Let me summarize now, and then we'll have time for you can raise some issues if you'd like. And I think we have microphones, do we? Okay, so maybe you could kind of be getting in position. So let me just summarize, if I may. This may have been, some of you, this is old hat. Others of you, it's new. And I hope that you all found something useful. Basically, I'm claiming that naturalism is a horrible worldview that will destroy this culture because of the sensate problem. And it really is. And it's also not true. That's another problem with it. And I tried to spell out the epistemology, and I raised objections against that. I spelled out its creation story, raised some problems against that, and then I raised the difficulty of the origin of the universe. There are a lot of other things we could say, but that's my that would be a simple, basic critique of naturalism without going further. Now, the good news is, as a Christian, I love science. I love it. I'm grateful for it. I think God gave it to us. I'm not against the legitimate claims of science, by any means. What I'm against is the idea that science is all there is. That's what my claim is. So the naturalist can't claim science on his side, because we have science on our side as well. They've got to claim that science is all there is, and that's what I've got to beef with. Thank you very much, and let's see if we can have a little time for discussion. So we've got some folks down here. All right. Joe?
Yeah, so I was curious with your point regarding the maintenance of, you know, the same personhood despite the changing parts, and that being based in the spiritual aspect of a person. Wouldn't that necessarily require that, you know, my pet dog is also a spiritual being in nature?
The question is, wouldn't my argument imply that my dog is a spiritual being? I believe that all living things have souls. This is an ancient view that goes back to Aristotle. It was the fundamental view of the Christian church up until Descartes. So from the time of the church fathers up through the late 1600s, almost all Christian thinkers believe that plants, animals, and humans have souls. A soul is a... What is a soul? A soul is a principle that gives life to an object. And so if you hold that vegetables are alive, it doesn't follow they're conscious. So I don't think plants are conscious, but I think they're living. And I think they have a principle of unity in them beyond their parts. So an animal soul and a human soul, what's an animal and a human soul? Basically, an animal and a human soul is an immaterial substance that contains consciousness and animates the body. So a dog's soul contains the dog's consciousness and animates the dog's body. Only the human soul is made in the image of God. A dog's soul is different from a cat's soul, for example. The way you can tell what an animal's soul is like is by attributing to an animal's soul only what is needed to explain its behavior, nothing more and nothing less. So, for example, the human soul and an animal soul can have a desire. Like I can have a desire for ice cream and an animal can have a desire for food, but an animal soul is not capable of having a desire to have a desire. I never see an animal sitting around giving behavioral evidence that it's working on its desires, that it's saying to itself, I've got a set of desires I'd like to change this year, so I'm going to set out and work on them. Humans have desires for their desires. That would be an example. Probably the only soul that survives the death of the body is the human soul, though I'm not completely sure about that. I could be wrong about that. But I think your argument's a very good one. You're right, that would follow on my argument that animals would have to have souls. But I think they do. Excellent, excellent point. Thank you.
I guess my question...
Where are you?
I'm right here.
Okay, yeah.
So as you were talking about like the sensate culture or whatever and how what ends up happening is people end up feeling like feel what's right, what I've been finding as I've been doing ministry is that people who are naturalists because it feels right as opposed to these arguments. So trying to discuss things with them about like, you know, their beliefs and their perspectives, they have no reasoning for it. And half the time they're not even aware of what they believe or why they believe it or what the implications are. And so I was curious if you had any advice in terms of like, how do you deal with someone who like adheres to these beliefs but has no understanding of like the undergirding of it?
Okay.
Like with that?
I think obviously the first thing you do is continue to love and try to minister to them where they're at. And that's obvious. I think to the degree that you'd like to try to talk to them a little bit, you can say things to a person like, would you be willing to have a conversation about some ideas that I think you might find interesting? And maybe they'll say, well, yeah, what are you thinking about? And then you could say, well, I think that there is a worldview called naturalism that's got some problems, and I'd like to share just briefly with you one of the reasons why I believe in God. And you might want to offer this origin of the universe argument for God. Now, let me tell you what that does. 9 times out of 10, a person can never repeat the argument. And they'll forget the argument. Most, probably a lot of you are going to forget the details of what I said, unless you go over your notes, and then you'll remember it. But life gets busy. I get that. What happens, though, is that we send the person a message. And the message is Christians are smart and they're not ignorant bigots. And that we haven't put our heads in the sand to believe what we have. We've got reasons for what we believe. And we're prepared to give them. At least some of us are, if for the rest of the body. We don't all have to do that. It's a division of labor in the body of Christ. We have different roles to play. But some of us are prepared to give those reasons. That sends a message to them, and I also think it's tremendously comforting for believers. Because the believing community needs to know that there's reason to believe all this. This isn't just a blind step in the dark. So I think that giving a person, engaging them in the level of ideas, isn't going to be particularly, won't generally be, it does sometimes, but it's not generally useful. In the sense that it's going to persuade them to change their mind on the spot, though that does happen sometimes. But it's still useful because it sends them a message that we're willing to engage at that level because we think our religion makes a ton of sense. And I think that's a big deal. Apart from that, I admit it's tough. You just have to kind of go with where a person's at. Someone else? I'm having trouble. Yes, please.
Yeah, how exactly would you apply this to evangelism? Kind of similar to the last question, but I've noticed that if you just start confronting people with these arguments, they'll often become defensive or offended and perhaps stop having discussions with you.
Yeah, I think that these kinds of arguments are better served in large meetings or in writings. So I think if you were at a high school or college campus or you wrote a letter to the editor of the local newspaper giving an argument in 500 words. Just write a brief editorial listing a couple of arguments for God. Or if you were asked to give a talk in a dorm, you could give something like this. Because it's less confrontational if it's in a big meeting or a small group setting or through writing. So I think these kinds of things can be especially helpful in more public settings where they create a mood or an atmosphere where people are willing to hear, then you go witness to somebody 2 weeks later and they think, geez, I might listen to what this guy has to say. One-on-one, I think you just start with where people are at and you leave it. If they don't have questions like this, don't go there. I think this kind of stuff is particularly helpful for Christians. And it has limited effect in evangelism, though it has some effect, but it's largely in seasoning the culture rather than winning an individual to Christ. That's been my experience. Yes.
Yes. Working with a younger group of children, do you have a simple, quick analogy of how God exists out of time, outside of time?
Yeah. The number two. Where's the number two? How big is it? How long has it existed? It kind of doesn't make any sense to ask, where's the number two? Where is it? I have a bump. My wife gave me a bumper, one of the things for my bumper, and it says, I break for the number two. And, which is kind of, you can't break for the number two. You could break for the numeral two, but not the number. So you might want to say, well, where are the laws of logic, or where are numbers? You do arithmetic, where are numbers? And pretty soon you begin to get the idea that they aren't anywhere. They're somehow outside space and time. And God's the same way. So if you're looking for an analogy, I would use things like numbers as an analogy of something that could exist without being in space and time. Now, if you're looking for a definition, there's a simple way of defining what it means for God to be spaceless and timeless. Let's just deal with timelessness. To say that God is timeless is to say that he has no temporal location or extension. Now, by a temporal location, that would mean a date, like the temporal location of John Kennedy's assassination had a temporal location. That was a date. A World War II had a temporal duration. It had a length. It was so many years. God has neither temporal location. You can't ask when was he, and he doesn't have temporal location or duration. You can't ask how long has he existed, unless you say forever, but forever usually means what they mean in California when they say whatever, and it basically is a punt. And what we mean when we say God exists forever is that he's never created, he's outside time, I think, at least without the universe. Okay, I'm one more, and then we'll call it in this dear lady here, and then this will be the last one, and I'm going to take a break.
Okay. Thanks. This is great, but my head is spinning. Well, so do you have a book that books, which would you recommend?
I wrote a book that is designed to give to a non-Christian who's willing to listen. And people kept saying, is there something I could give to my uncle or my roommate in the dorm? And it's here. It's called The God Question. And it's a book written to an unbeliever who would just be willing to at least hear me out and make a case for this, and then explain how you can fall in love with Jesus without becoming religious. And that's a wonderful thing. I'd like to thank my dear sister here, especially for attending. And remember, we're laughing at you, not with you. All right. So, and thank you for coming. Bless you.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.